Coming up on Fronteras, with the release of hundreds of immigrants from ICE custody in recent days, those immigrants are now making their way back home.
I took one who got released on Saturday. We took him all the way to Fresno, California.
Coming up, the next steps for the newly released. And stores that cater to growing minority groups are doing well as the country's demographics continue to change.
You got the verdolagas, which bonds in some of the stores, they don't have it.
The secrets of one highly successful family-owned supermarket chain. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created through an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among seven public radio stations funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of its Local Journalism Center initiative. I'm Crystal Chavez. Hundreds of immigrants are heading back to their families after being released from U.S. detention centers. Immigration and Customs Enforcement says it's released low-risk detainees for budget reasons, as federal lawmakers grapple with the threat of automatic sequestration cuts. Fronteras desk reporter Ju Jaffe Block caught up with some people in Phoenix who've just had their first taste of freedom in a long time.
This Greyhound bus station near the Phoenix airport is the first stop for many immigrants released from immigration detention centers in Arizona. Taxi driver Henry Williams is here at the station most nights. He says it's normal to see a few people dropped off from immigration detention centers, but last weekend was unusual.
This Saturday, it was humongous. There was three busloads.
That's because starting late last week, ICE began releasing certain detainees who weren't a priority for detention, about 12% of the detained population in the state. The agency says the releases are winding down now, but it was an effort to save money given the pending budget crisis. The unusual move provoked outrage from several prominent Republicans, including Arizona's governor. Whatever the fallout, it meant good business for taxis here.
I took one who got released on Saturday. We took him all the way to Fresno, California.
That's an 8.5-hour drive. William says the customer didn't have much money on him, but his family paid the fare of $1,400 when they arrived. Many immigrants detained here in Arizona don't have ties to the state and are trying to get to other parts of the country. At 8:30 at night, a van from the detention facility in Florence pulls up across the street. Five men get out, each with a paper bag with their belongings. One is Reynaldo Mejia, a 21-year-old from El Salvador with a black goatee.
Fui detenido hace ya varios meses.
Mejia says he was detained for several months after he was apprehended at the border. He noticed people were being released this weekend.
Sentí una esperanza, alegría, porque
he says he felt hope, happiness, that his turn would come, and thank goodness it did. He has no ID on him except the official bracelet from the detention facility that's still on his wrist. This Greyhound station is essentially the first place he's been in the U.S. as a free man. His family bought him a bus ticket to join them in Los Angeles. That's also where he has to show up for court next month, because like all immigrants recently released from detention, his immigration case hasn't been dismissed. He still faces the possibility of deportation. They gave me a document with the date and address of where I have to show up, he says. A half hour later, about a dozen more people arrive. They say from Eloy in central Arizona. A man who doesn't give his name says his release was a nice surprise.
I got happy. I got to go to see my kids.
How long has it been?
18 months.
He's headed back to California. A skinny 24-year-old who only gives his name as Francisco is shivering with excitement in the parking lot. He's just borrowed a taxi driver's phone to call relatives in Mesa to pick him up.
No sabían que iban a, que iba a llegar, pues.
They didn't know I was coming, he says. Francisco will have to check in with ICE officers in Phoenix while he waits for his court date. He says he was in danger in Mexico and came to ask for asylum here. When I ask him what he'll do now that he's no longer detained, he doesn't hesitate.
Trabajar y trabajar. Echarle ganas.
Work and work and give it my all, he says. In Phoenix, I'm Jude Joffe Block.
The collective buying power of the Latino population in the U.S. will reach an estimated $1.5 trillion in 2015. And market research says they'll be spending a lot of that money on food. From our Fronteras desk, Jill Replegal tells us about one family business whose growth banks on Latinos' love for home-cooked food and food from the home country.
Nopales, tomates, chiles,
dulces, mexicanos. Los moles.
This is what customers love about Northgate Gonzalez Markets.
You got the verdolagas, which bonds in some of the stores, they don't have it.
Todo, todo fresco.
I find everything here.
That was Patty Chavez, Consuelo Duarte, Juan Mendez, and Alicia Ray, all happy customers of one of the newest Northgate Gonzalez supermarkets, this one located in San Diego's historic Latino district, Barrio Logan. Trapped between a shipyard and one of California's busiest highways, Barrio Logan residents used to have almost nowhere to buy fresh fruits, meats, and vegetables. So neighbors were ecstatic when Northgate Gonzalez decided to build a big, airy market here. At the store's opening last December, a local priest came to bless it. He said it was a miracle to have such a beautiful store in Barrio Logan, and he joked that Northgate Gonzalez co-owner Miguel Gonzalez had the face of a saint before sprinkling holy water over the employees. The Gonzalez Reynoso family and its growing Southern California supermarket chain is a classic tale of the entrepreneurial immigrant. Miguel Gonzalez and his late father, also Miguel, opened the first Northgate Gonzalez market in Latino-heavy downtown Anaheim in 1980. 33 years later, Miguel Jr. and his 12 brothers and sisters own 37 stores in L.A., Orange, and San Diego counties. Their newer markets have bulk food sections like you find in health food stores. They sell prepared foods, carnitas, ceviches, salsas, and aguas frescas. Cumbia plays over the speaker system, and TV screens in the meat department show soccer games and Mexican talk shows. The company's success stems from a mix of business smarts, entrepreneurial risk-taking, and let's call it demographic good timing. Thanks to the growing Latino and Asian populations in the U.S., so-called ethnic supermarkets have seen their revenues rise in recent years, while the industry as a whole has been losing money. Something else that probably helps the Northgate Gonzalez empire, it's run by a really tight family.
Victor, he's right now in charge of marketing and the older brother, Ramon.
I'm standing with Miguel Gonzalez in front of a life-size mural of the Gonzalez Reynoso family. It stretches across the wall in the main conference room of the company's corporate headquarters and distribution center in Anaheim. Miguel's mother and stern-faced father stand in the middle of their 13 children. Miguel says they knew nothing about grocery stores when they started. After Miguel sold his house and his father refinanced his to open their first store, they had $240 left to run it.
For I think it was about a year and a half, we only used the family to work. We used to do everything, I mean, from the carnitas, chicharrones, and then different brothers went to the meat, some for the grocery, the sisters into the check stands.
As the business grew, the family looked to open stores in low-income and minority neighborhoods, where more mainstream supermarkets had either failed or had no interest in opening in the first place. That strategy now aligns with a national health push with some high-level backers.
It's a story about bringing fresh, healthy, affordable food into communities that need it most.
This, of course, is First Lady Michelle Obama. Last year, she visited a Northgate Gonzalez store in L.A. as part of her Let's Move health campaign. Northgate Gonzalez's efforts to improve their customers' health include in-store cooking demonstrations and a line of foods identified for shoppers as healthy choices. Back in Barrio Logan, customers rave about the beautiful produce, huge selection of meats, prepared Mexican dishes, and tortillas made in-store from scratch. A reviewer on Yelp called Northgate Gonzalez Whole Foods Market for the working-class Latinos. What he most loves, one shopper told me, is when he hits his local Northgate Gonzalez market on the weekend, it's like being in Mexico. In San Diego, I'm Jill Replegal.
There's still more Fronteras coming up. We hear from a Texas soldier who's now telling his story through creative writing.
There were a couple of times in that first half of the deployment when I It was up in the air. Well, I don't know if I'm going to survive this mission.
Combat veteran Chris Hernandez shares his story after the break. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. On this program, we like to introduce you to musicians, artists, and authors from across the Southwest. Today, we're speaking to San Antonio, Texas writer Chris Hernandez. He has 24 years of military experience. Hernandez started off in the Marine Reserves and then switched to the Army National Guard in 95. He's served in Iraq and Afghanistan, most recently at the end of 2009. These days, Hernandez is putting his thoughts on paper and says most of his writing has to do with his experience on the front lines.
It almost all does. I have a book published right now. It's titled Proof of Our Resolve. It was published by a company called Tactical 16, a small independent publisher that just does military stuff. And that is a novel loosely based on my experience in Afghanistan. It's just telling the story of a bunch of Texas National Guard soldiers and their fight against a Taliban cell. The other two books that I have completed but not published, they also revolve around soldiers. They take place in the United States, but it's still almost military situations.
And one of the stories I read was from a book, Deserts and Mountains. It's from a vet arts cooperative based in Austin. They say they want to grow possibly to San Antonio. Tell me a little bit about the piece you wrote for that sort of creative writing workshop.
That piece that I wrote was titled I Won't Change Them. It's just a conversation between my protagonist, Jerry Nunez. He's a platoon sergeant in an infantry platoon, and he's having a conversation with his lieutenant about an upcoming mission. And it's just trying to describe the basic issue that we have, or one of the basic issues we have in Afghanistan, of trying to be friendly versus trying to do things the right way militarily to minimize risk to us. And there's always a debate between, you know, being the hardcore aggressive and keeping your guys from getting killed versus being friendly and open and trying to engage the Afghan population in the hopes that in the future they will be more pro-coalition, that they'll be more open to what we're trying to do.
Would you mind reading a little piece of that, maybe your favorite part, if you can find it?
Let's see. How about this? Nunez's platoon would accompany an Afghan army company into the Afghania Valley in 2 days. They had two ways to do it. The Afghan company hadn't been notified about the upcoming mission, and as far as Nunez was concerned, they should be told at the last minute. That way, no Taliban sympathizers could give advance warning to the enemy. The other way to do it was to let the Afghan troops and villagers know days beforehand. Send messages saying, "Hey guys, we're coming, but we're not looking for a fight. We just want to talk to people and hand out free stuff." The villagers would supposedly tell their Taliban sons and brothers not to attack the Americans and would guarantee their safety. Nunez looked toward his boots, invisible in the dark. He had memorized the shapes of the bloodstains on them. Bloodstains from his friend Jared Stout, shot through the throat in a village whose name Jared never even knew, killed on the last mission where they tried to be friendly. Nunez closed his eyes, remembering that day. He hated his last memory of Jared. Jared had been an older, overweight family man with 5 kids, always making stupid jokes, always laughing. The only times Nunez saw him serious were before missions, when he prayed over every soldier in his vehicle. The last time Nunez saw Jared, 2 soldiers were dragging his corpse downhill, head first and on his back, over jumbles of rocks. Nunez had watched in anger and thought, "You're hurting him." Then he turned off his feelings and went back to his job. Live soldiers still needed him.
Wow. Is that based on true experiences?
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
You mentioned in that story you have someone, a soldier who's all about winning hearts and minds, and another soldier who's about more of an aggressive approach.
Right.
Who are you like?
Well, people who have read my book accuse me of being Jerry Nunez, and we have a lot in common. But Jerry is, he's kind of the guy that I wish I could be, and Jerry is definitely more of the aggressive type, but it's because he thinks that we're wasting our time, we're spinning our wheels trying to do things the other way because it doesn't work in his mind. I'm more, I guess, kind of in the middle of between Jerry and his lieutenant. You know, the lieutenant's very idealistic, and you know, even though he knows the reality, he still says we need to be friendly so that in the future we don't have to keep coming back here and fighting the same people. And, you know, I'm somewhere right in between.
Does your ethnicity or your race play in a factor in any of your military experience? Did it at all?
I don't think so. In the Marine Corps especially, there's a lot of Hispanic Marines. And in my experience, we weren't looked on any differently than anyone else. You know, you hear jokes, that's one of the great things about the military is you can stand in a circle with, you know, white guys, black guys, Hispanics, Asians, and just tell each other racial jokes that in any other setting would just, you know, infuriate everyone. But we're all Marines, we're all soldiers, and it's told in the spirit of brotherhood, if you can believe that. And it doesn't make anyone mad. It's just something for all of us to laugh about. One of the great things about the military is it is the great equalizer. It's all about what you can do. It's all about your performance. It's all about how well you do your job and whether or not you can be trusted. And when you get to a certain point, especially in wartime, nobody cares what your ethnic background is. So, there were definitely, it definitely came into play at times, especially in Afghanistan, because most Afghans, if you put them on the street in San Antonio, everyone would think they were Mexican. Everyone would think they were Hispanic. And I had several times in Afghanistan of Afghan villagers walking up to me, even when I was wearing an American uniform, American flag on my shoulder, come up and start speaking Pashto to me because they thought that I was Afghan. And I think maybe that kind of helped sometimes. I know that I identified with them a little bit more than some of the other soldiers, especially the children, because all their kids look like my kids.
Wow.
So, you know, it had flashes of importance, I guess, but my ethnic background never really determined anything in the military.
I see. Well, back to your book, the one that's published. Tell me a little bit about that one.
That one, it's titled Proof of Our Resolve. It is about a Texas National Guard infantry platoon in Afghanistan. It's set in the place where I served, which was Kapisa Province. It's the smallest province in Afghanistan you typically don't hear a lot about. But it's up in the northeast, a very mountainous area. It was just beautiful. Unfortunately, all that vegetation gives the enemy places to hide, but it was a really interesting place to be. And the story is about this Texas National Guard infantry platoon working alongside the French, fighting a Taliban cell that's setting IEDs, setting roadside bombs, and destroying coalition vehicles.
What does writing about this do for you? Does it help?
Well, it does help. I didn't realize how much it helped when I first started. And kind of the looking back on my history writing, I feel kind of stupid sometimes because when I first started writing, I thought I was just writing a cool story. And it wasn't until I really got into the writing and looking back over what I read that I realized I was just dumping all of this, you know, emotional turmoil and stuff that I had, which was natural coming out of that situation. So a lot of it was a catharsis. Hopefully not too much of it was, because generally I think if you're just dumping emotions, you're probably not writing a very good book. So I had to go back and make sure that wasn't the only driver, that I was, you know, forming a coherent plot and putting all the necessary ingredients to make it a good book that's going to appeal to somebody who wasn't in Afghanistan, to the average reader who's just curious about what it was like. But yeah, a lot of my personal experience went into it. A lot of the conflicted emotions that I had when I came back went into it.
Did it help you sort through emotions and figure things out?
It did, to a degree. You know, when I came back out of Afghanistan, I was, and I am, extremely proud of my service, and I'm extremely proud of the guys I served with, and there's no way I would ever take that experience back. You know, if I had the opportunity that, well, you could go back in time and not go to Afghanistan, I would not do it. You know, I wouldn't give up those memories. But at the same time, when I came back, I was so frustrated at the things that happened and the difficulties of this mission that we've undertaken of trying to bring democracy to a place that isn't built for democracy, and that's just my opinion. A lot of the things that we try to do which just don't seem to be working, I was carrying around all that frustration also. And, you know, and specific losses of people on missions that I was on and stuff like that. And in writing all of this, I really kind of figured out where I stand. I was able to solidify a little bit of, okay, well, there's this much of it, 80% of it, that 80% of what I'm feeling is pride, 20% is frustration, and I'm okay with that.
Tell me about your family. You're married?
I am married. I'm married. I have four children. I'm actually, as of late last year, I'm a grandfather. My daughter's married to a Marine, and I've got a little granddaughter. Probably the interesting thing, you know, my wife having to live with two deployments, you know, with the kids by herself, probably the most interesting point there is that my last child was born 3 days after I got to Afghanistan.
Wow. So and you weren't there?
I wasn't there. It's the only one whose birth I wasn't there for. And he was born with some medical issues. So she had to deal with all that stuff by herself. And I went through the first half of my deployment until I went on leave, not knowing if I would survive to see my child. And there were a couple of times in that first half of the deployment when it was up in the air. Well, I don't know if I'm going to survive this mission. That was, for me, that I think it sort of took me back to my grandparents' generation, because in my family, we have people who have served in the military all the way back to World War I. But the World War II generation, they had to deal with those same things of being away from family for a lot longer than I was, and being away from children and not knowing if they were going to make it back. And so it sort of helped me, I think, connect with that generation that I've always held in very high regard.
That was San Antonio writer Chris Hernandez talking about his experiences serving in the U.S. military. You've been listening to Fronteras, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting-funded journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. Fronteras is online at fronterasdesk.org. We're also on Facebook, and we invite you to join the conversation and post your thoughts about our stories. For headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is fronterasdesk. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Our theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.